Okay, so thank you very much for the opportunity to have this discussion session here. Here is what I will talk about. And first I will tell about some basics of RF spectroscopy and the experiment done in Innsbruck. Some of you know this stuff already, but maybe some others don't, so I try to briefly go through them. And then I present sort of insider details about this thing, things that you have to remember if you want to really interpret this kind of results or calculate yourself. There are some little details which are, however, important, like these kind of things. And this method is somehow related to ARPAS, but it's not the same. So maybe in the end of this part, we can try to establish the connection together. But please don't start to talk about it before I have gone up to here, because yeah, here you will know much more about the details. Then I want to present some recent results that we have about FFLO in imbalanced gases. And finally, I thought we could discuss these new experiments by Ketelä, where he does RF spectroscopy in imbalanced gases. And I have just collected the data and I have a few remarks, but this can be really like a free discussion. So like everything, but here, I mean, I'm talking about somebody else's work. Okay, so let's go back to 2004. What was the situation there? There were many experiments coming about strongly interacting Fermi gases, and this pairing gap observation was one of them. These molecules have been seen, and the fermion pairs, and density profiles, and collective modes, and then this one came. And then the following year, vortices were observed. So it was not really established whether there is the superfluid or not at that point. And this was the first observation of the pairing gap, and it was done in Innsbruck in Rudy Krim's group, and we published a paper basically. I mean, we collaborated, but there are two following papers in Science where we explain the basic features of this spectroscopy. But let's go first to what is this kind of thing. To use this kind of thing to probing the pairing gap in superfluids was proposed by Peter Soller and myself a long time ago. And such method was used for observing mean fields, so not superfluidity, but mean fields, by Debbie Chins and Volkan Getter's group. So the idea is like this. You have atoms in two internal states of the atom, and these pair via S-wave pairing, as you know. And then there is a third state, and for concreteness, for lithium 6, they are these ones, so the energies go something like this. There are some high field seeking states, 6 hyperfine states. And now in my notation, 1 and 2 are the ones here, and 3 is this one. So these two are paired, and then you drive a transition from here to there. Okay. And as you see in this schematic, to be able to drive that transition, you have to also provide the energy that it is needed for, so to speak, breaking the pair. Or in more elegant language, you leave one excitation in the superfluid behind you when this one goes there, so this becomes an excitation, and therefore you have to provide this pairing gap energy. So if you take the spectrum, for completely free atoms, 2 and 3, it would sit here, I have marked that zero is the point for the transition between this. So you have zero detuning, this is the detuning of the RF field. And then with the pairing there, the peak is shifted to something that is proportional to delta, but it's not exactly, as I will discuss in the future. Now this one, this process is to some extent analogous to this. If you have a superconducting metal and normal metal, then you put a voltage. Then as a function of voltage, you have to have a certain voltage, and before that, you get some current. Now the detuning here corresponds to the voltage, but the curve is very different, and that's because in this process, momentum is conserved exactly, and therefore you have something like a transition peak and not this kind of thing. Yeah. Oh, here somehow, in some sense, you have a tunneling coupling. So the states 2 and 3, they are coupled by a, you know, rubby type of. This is the Hamiltonian. So they are coupled by the, and this is like the tunneling matrix here. But the difference comes from the fact that this is, in at least in this direction, it's very localized, and therefore you don't have to conserve momentum on this barrier. But this process conserves momentum exactly, and the momentum of the radio frequency field is negligible.
Would you say that there is another analogy, which is sound detonation superconductor?
Sorry, which is?
Well, sound detonation superconductor was once suggested as a way to prepare the effect. I would say it actually is much closer.
Yeah, yeah, this is closer to other things. I mean, yeah, it is related to the sound
attenuation.
Sound attenuation. It's somehow closely analogous to this in the sense that you can describe extremely. I mean, you take the same formalism, you just impose momentum conservation, and then you get this result.
You're going to talk about this in more detail? Or?
Yeah. It's just the first qualitative thing. Okay. I will first talk about some other things and then I go to the details. So when we calculated the spectra for this paper, it was important to somehow include possible pseudogap effects there, because this is basically this measures the single particle excitations, and from there you cannot know anything about, basically anything about superfluidity. It's just about pairing. So we wanted to have some theory that includes pseudogap, so that we can follow in the theory when do we have pseudogap and when it goes to the superfluid gap. And we chose to use the model developed by Cathy Levin's group. We could have used some other also. At this point, this choice of this particularly and not some other, like what Strinati is using, was not important. Yeah, the whole curve and in different temperatures. The whole, I mean, this spectra at different temperatures.
And I at different parts of the DC crossover?
Yeah.
For different detunings?
Yes, okay. Yes.
And what changes, how does it change from that basic, maybe you do the
Yes, well, over the crossover, if you want to know now, in the PEC side, it's more like molecule breaking. So you get like molecular dissociation curve. It's not so much like a beak, but it's really, and how does it go then, if some of you know better? Does it go down or up a bit? And the, in the far PEC side, this is simply breaking of molecules, and you get the same kind of thing that you get from a molecular dissociation.
It's not a peak, you're saying,
it's kind of a threshold? Yeah, it's just a threshold, and then it goes somehow. I don't remember how it goes here, but it's a very sharp threshold, and then, you know, something. And
right, it goes down.
Yeah. It goes down somehow, but not very fast. Or yeah, it goes somehow down. But the thing is that it's really sharp here, because the pairing there is just a two-body effect. There is no many-body effect. It's just a molecular binding energy here. And then at the crossover, well, you get the peak like that. This is at resonance. And at the BCS side, you also get the peak. But it becomes much closer to zero for reasons that I will tell later, and narrower.
So the point is, in the molecular side, there's no quasi-particle.
Well, this, you remember, this is a trap system. So the thing, for instance, what causes that there is not such a broad thing, but this threshold, is that the molecules have the same binding energy everywhere in the trap. Whereas if you calculate the gap, fermion pairing gap, it depends on the density, and it's very different in different places of the trap, so therefore you get quite a broad beak here. And there are also other reasons for this broadening and this shape. Okay, so, yeah. We use the Hamiltonian that is really studied a lot, and in context of atoms by these people recently. We had this Vespa, or these molecules in the closed channel there, but that's not very essential. Later we have used the single channel model, but it was not known at that point whether these are important or not, even in the broad resonance case. Okay, so this description contains a pseudo gap, so these are like non-condensed pairs, and then the Cooper pair, real Cooper pair contribution, and the total gap is the sum of them. So, well, it's a part of the T matrix for non-zero energy. So it's like pairs, but the pairs are not condensed. These are the pairs that you get also above TC.
Why do you have two gaps there, delta superconductor and delta pseudo gap? Isn't it the same thing?
Well, in this Cathy Levin's formulation, it is like this, and one can do other theories also. So basically, one just needs to somehow describe the fluctuations of the order parameter. And we just chose to use this one. One could use some other things, but
Technically, one is exponential value of B, and the other one is the Hubbard-Tripanovich female to be coupled according to interaction.
I mean this is not has nothing to do with this one. You get this thing also if you have a single channel model.
I think this is just the fluctuation term.
Yeah, this is the fluctuation term. Yeah. So this has nothing to do with these ones, right? So we could have dropped this and considered that one. Okay.
And this implies why we're solar.
Yeah.
One thing we can understand is why resonance, why there would be particles.
We don't need this piece. But they were there because it was 2004, and it was not yet established whether you need them or not for the white resonance. Now we know that you don't need, but we put them there just to be sure. But later we have done it for the single channel model, and it's okay. All right, and this is now how the spectrum, what it contains. So this thing, the main thing that we calculate, and it has eaten the spectral functions for the, my notation now is changing, it seems here. So one corresponds to G, and this three, this normal one, three, this corresponds to E. So the normal state and superfluid state spectral functions have gone in there. And So in the superfluid, I'm sorry, I have used two different notations in this talk. I will go back to my original. So I had one and two, and these are the paired. And three is the non-paired, the normal. And sometimes I also call these G and G prime, and this one E.
G sub G is the 1, 2, 4.
Yeah. So this is the superfluid correlator, and this is the normal one. And because
E would be just a simple pole, and this E would be just.
This is very simple, the delta function basically. And because the momentum conservation is there, you are left with only one momentum summation here. So this momentum conservation has already been implemented there. And
so KK or DSU, that's a function, known function?
This is just a tunneling matrix element, so to speak, and here it is the Rabi frequency of the field, and it is K independent. So these, yes, these Ks, you can drop them and take them this out.
And the G sub G is the normal, it's the side arrow 1, side 2?
This is like a just the normal, but it's the same for the one and the two, and I mean two is the one that I'm actually transferring, so it's this thing. Okay, and then we did local density approximation and simply took a Thomas Fermi profile for the gas arm dependence, so this is harmonic trap and so on, and the order parameter then looks, for instance, like this, if you apply local density approximation.
Did you take that into account in the calculation of G sub G?
No. So at each point R, we calculate this thing, but putting in the local chemical potential, and then we get the current at that point. And finally, we average over the whole trap by multiplying this response with the density there. So this one is like the homogeneous case formula, but you put in a certain chemical potential that corresponds to the place where you're in the trap. And later you average. Mm-hmm.
Is the excited state trap?
Yeah, we assume that. Yeah, it's the same trap, because then you get a nice overlap integrals. I mean, here then you would have something else if it's not trapped. And in fact, in the experiment it is, sort of. Yeah, it is.
Suppose you don't assume any trap. Mm-hmm. What are the main features that come out of that?
I mean, I'm coming to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we could explain with this. Okay, so there are two main points that we could make based on this calculation. And first is related really to trapping. And it's this thing that here you see the calculated spectra at different temperatures. The measured spectra look very similar. And here at high temperatures, where you supposedly have no pairing, you have the peak at zero, like I draw here. And then the pairing peak starts to appear at the different
points. Where are you from?
Hmm?
Where are you?
This is something like KFA minus 3, or I don't know, minus 2. Yeah, it's in the unitary regime. But it's not exactly in resonance, because at that point the point of resonance was not known. But it's somewhere in the unitary PCS. Negative. PCS side, but at the unitary regime.
Sorry, can we go back to the previous one which had the two G's?
Yes.
So what are you putting in for one case? You're putting in just a pole for a bound state? What are you putting
in? Here I take the I take the spectral function given by this pseudogap theory. I mean, in some limit, that would be just the BCS spectral function.
How would you, when you say, do you use a BCS form, but that would be, that would have the coherence factors? I guess I'm not sure.
No.
The Green's function?
Yeah, in the BCS, if you use just BCS theory, you would get something proportional to this one plus some delta function, and so there is no, if you mean.
Yes, my concern is that that is not, that has coherence. This state.
No, they don't come up here because you couple the superfluid to normal state and you don't get them. This, you mean this kind of terms? They don't come there.
I guess what I'm asking is that if I had a true superconductor with coherence, that's the kind of Green's function I would write down, or spectral function.
Yeah.
But now you said something about trying to write it on the pseudogap phase, so it doesn't have coherence but has pairing, so.
That's what you're. Yeah. Okay. You know, this really measures the. Just a single particle spectrum, so there is not so dramatic effect on the spectral function for the pseudogap, except that you have like pairs that have a momentum in some sense. But
We
never separated them. Because it was not so relevant here. The excitation gap that you will see in the spectrum is this one, and it contains the superfluid and the pseudogap. So from the experimental peak, you will never resolve them directly. So we never calculated them, the spectral weights, separately, so to speak. I don't know whether it's even sort of possible. I never thought about it. Okay, so the point here is that there are these two peaks. And you see that this other peak persists for quite low temperature. So it's not that at some point everybody becomes paired, but it's a kind of smooth development. And that comes from the fact that this gas is trapped. Because in a homogeneous system, you would get like first you have this peak and then you have that peak and that's it. But here the trap looks something like this. So at the edges, the effective or the local, so to speak, critical temperature is lower. And at a certain temperature, the particles that are here are not paired. Or again, more elegant way of saying is that you have Andreev states here, below gap states, and these can be easily thermally populated. So that's the origin of the other peak. And in some sense, that works as a nice thermometry, because you can sort of follow in which temperature you possibly are. And we calculated as a function of temperature what is the proportion of the pseudo gap and the real superfluid gap, so that we know that at a certain temperature below TC we have, for instance, 80 or 99% of the gap is a real superfluid gap. And we know how the spectra looks for that particular temperature then. And this, in this way, we can connect the experiment. I mean, we can look at a certain spectra in the experiment and try to deduce at which temperature is it, and look from our curves whether it has just pseudo gap pairing or a mostly superfluid gap.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. What would you expect to see if you had only two atoms and did the same calculation? Do you think that the spectrum that you have, this appears, the second peak that you see, would appear or disappear? Do you expect any?
It depends when where you are in the BCS-BC crossover. If you are here, yeah, certainly that. Those two atoms, they would pair, and you could see this if you can get a signal from one particle. But
No, I'm just trying to understand.
No,
what
sorry.
Is the dilute limit, non-degenerate limit, would show the same features?
No, he's asking whether it would happen at two atoms. At two atoms, you wouldn't have a
single gap. Well, the gap is something completely
mysterious
for me.
Yeah, but
I'm just saying, if you made this equation.
Yeah.
Would it appear for the two atoms? Resonant.
So the experiment, in the experiment, of course, then you can do it in the theory. You can do this thing as a function of the Fermi energy, and the bearing gap, it really depends on Fermi energy on the this side of the resonance. On resonance and on the BCS side. So it is a many body effect. It's the at least based on that it really depends on the Fermi energy, whereas here at the molecular side it doesn't depend on, and that's one thing that they did in the experiment. Well, at zero temperature. So certainly at the BEC side it is known that if you take this type of Hamiltonian and calculate, you don't get correctly the molecule interaction term. We never worked really much on that side because it's known to fail, but here at resonance it should still be quite good at zero temperature.
At zero temperature, for example, will not predict your correct ground state energy. And the ground state energy is not the Fermi energy times some universal number. And the Hamiltonian, this approach, Minfield approach, will not give it to you. Say it again? I mean, if you take Minfield approach, exactly at any parity, and calculate ground state energy, you'll get a number which will be the wrong number, not the right one. By some percent.
Yeah, but.
0.59 versus 0.44 in North Dakota.
So, of course.
Berkeley actually, no, so what I'm asking is, what we already started from something which deviates quite a lot, even zero temperature from the correct answer, then including to the gap effect, we started with something which is doesn't work, and left with some more subtle effects. So how can we expect
that? No, but the purpose of this thing was really to do this kind of very rough thermometry of trying to conclude that, for instance, this peak, that are they possibly in the superfluid phase or not? So
what are you concluding? I'm a bit unsure about what.
So the total order parameter is like this. It consists of these ones. So this is the thing that BCS theory would give.
Two fitting parameters in your G's. Is that how?
No, they are not fitting parameters. They come out of the calculation in the same way as. I mean, this is just the normal BCS gap, so you solve your gap and number equations iteratively and it comes out. And this comes out in the same way. So they are not fitting parameters, they are calculated.
In this case, the delta without any subscript is what goes into the spectrum?
Yeah, this is what the single particle spectrum shows.
But the gap equation only depends on delta SF? So the gap equation is written only for delta SF?
No, it's it includes also this one. So you have a self energy there where this comes also into play.
I'm having a little trouble with this delta SF and delta pseudo because I think of them as the same energy scale. As not being two different energy scales. So I guess I don't know that clearly.
I think this goes.
What are these two energy scales? There's only one energy scale from the delta. So it's not clear to me what. I can understand if you were just putting in some Gaussians in the G's and doing some fitting, but yes, if you could give like a quick background on what are.
Yeah, maybe I go back. No, I said that we could have used some other, like Strinati does it differently. And then there is this theory by Hausmann, which is very difficult to implement. But we try to do it now to compare how these different versions. So to have this particular theory is not important. It's just that we cannot use simple BCS theory and try to describe high temperatures. We have to take the fluctuation into account in some way. I don't claim that this is the best way, but it's one way. And I believe that it gives the, for instance, the correct understanding that for this kind of picture there is probably some pseudo gap present, and here there is most probably no pseudo gap anymore.
And how do you conclude that? Because there is still a finding there.
I conclude it in the following way, that we can calculate whether we have pseudo gap at a certain temperature, let's say this half of TC. We have this much of pseudo gap there and that much of a superfluid gap. And we know that at this point, for instance, 0.2 of TC, it's almost totally superfluid gap. And then we know how the spectrum looks like at a certain temperature, because there is this two-peak structure. It's easy to distinguish different temperatures from that. And then we look at the experimental spectrum. If it looks, for instance, like this, we say that it's probably around this temperature, and then we can look from here, this much pseudo gap and this much superfluid gap. And I don't believe this to be exact in the sense that we really know the proportion and so on. But I believe that it's very good at saying that, for instance, here, where you don't see anything here, and this is temperature like this, it's a totally superfluid. And then when we see in the experimental picture that this other peak has disappeared, we can conclude that they are in the superfluid regime.
So the temperature is fitting parameter in this?
There is no fitting parameter. This is just a calculated spectra.
I guess if it's a living parameter, then you could ask what's the difference between the spacing of the two peaks.
Yeah, so they are. This is in EF and this is in kilohertz, but we got the peak for some reason a bit higher place than here. So this, they don't quantitatively fit in that sense. So and that's probably because this theory is not completely correct.
Is the position of response to sum to delta? So for example,
I will come to that. Let's say within factor of two, yes, but I will explain why it's not exactly. Right. Okay, so this was basically the story that we explained why there are two peaks, and with this theory we could say something about when do they really go to superfluid. And yeah, we have done some other work on that, but now I tell you some of these details that you should remember if you want to.
It depends presumably on energy.
Which energy?
On the energy of the fermion that you're
You mean on the Fermi energy? Yes.
Well, no, on the energy. I mean, you can flip any of the any particle with any momentum, you can flip it to the state three.
Yes.
So
in principle, yes.
So,
yeah, you will see it when I write down some formulas here. So some things that you should remember if you now want to, for instance, interpret these catalyst experiments and calculate yourself this kind of spectrum. So you should remember that now if I think about this as this superfluid normal transition or tunneling or whatever, you have to remember that this normal side is now completely empty. And when you put your RF field, you at the same time you try to transfer all of your particles. And the energy conservation relation that you have here, it looks like this. So this is now the detuning of the RF field, so the energy that you give. This has to match the following. This is just the free particle energy in the superfluid side. I mean, this is now in BCS theory, but this is for illustration. So it looks like this. And now, so you can principle move any k state if you just choose this correctly so that it fulfills this energy conservation. Now if this part would be Pauli blocked, so if you would have here also the same Fermi surface as here, then you could not transfer particles from here to there because it's simply Pauli blocking. The first kind of transfer that you could make is around Fermi surface, and then you see immediately from this that this goes to zero, this goes to zero, and your delta is the gap energy. So if you have perfect Pauli blocking here, you will directly see from the shift of the peak the bearing energy. But now without Pauli blocking, Again, you see immediately from here that the smallest energy for which you can transfer something is when you put this to zero. So, come on. And yeah, can Taylor expand it there. Comes delta squared over 2 mu approximately. So the peak does not come immediately at delta. In fact, in BCS limit, where this is small compared to that one, it becomes in quite close to zero, actually. Now, when we are at the resonance, this Fesbach resonance, fortunately, we have almost a situation that mu equals delta, if you think that delta is half EF and mu is also sort of there. So in that case, at Fesbach resonance, you have something like that. It gives the pairing gap, but maybe divided by 2 or something. So this is now the threshold. So if you have a peak, it's like this point. And then in the BCS limit, I mean, with the BCS theory, one can also have the density of states in the front and analytically calculate where does this peak then come, this maximum. And for the Fesbach resonance, these are really some numbers like 0.4 delta and 0.5 delta. So don't take this seriously. You have to calculate if you want to do it. But
sorry, I'm completely lost. Uh-huh. You're talking about excitation energies in a superfluid here. I thought that's what being measured.
No, this is what you measure.
Well, if I go back to your expression, you have G sub
yeah.
G.
Yeah.
So you're looking for spectral pictures in a single particle Green's function in the superconductor. Mm. Is that correct?
Well, let me explain it like this.
That's what I should be thinking of.
Yeah, in the calculation there is the spectral function of the superconductor. Yes.
Right here. Single part. You're trying to find the poles in a single particle Green's
function. This is not anymore that one because initially.
And what are you trying to do?
This is the final result.
For the peaks, the single part of the range.
I can explain. So, initially, if my response is something like this, so I calculate it like this. There is momentum integration, and then you have the spectral function of the superfluid, spectral function of the normal gas, and so on. Let's put 2 momenta here. Whatever. And then I have, for instance, because this is special for this system, I have momentum conservation. And now, and this one, you know, it would be, for instance, sometime in the BCS theory, something like this and a certain delta function. This is also a delta function, but a different. Now I do this integration, and these get messed up. So this is not. This energy conservation is not directly this one.
Here I'm computing the momentum integration of some all shell single particle.
What you got K and then omega minus delta minus epsilon K. So if the discussion at the end down the pre state this and these.
Yeah.
Okay. Fine, but still, you know, something single particle Green's function. I don't know where this is coming from here.
This one is the, if you combine all of these and you do the Matsubara summations and whatever, you are left with something times one single delta function.
Yes.
And this is this one, basically. So it's a bit messed up in the sense that Yeah, if you would have initially some particles in the state 3, the same Fermi level as for these, you would directly see delta, but now you don't. You see something else, which fortunately at the strongly interacting gas, it's almost like delta. But if you want now, for instance, do your Monte Carlo calculation or something and get the bearing gap there, and you want to compare to the experiment really with accuracy more than factor of 2, then you have to calculate the spectra in this way and see where the peak comes. This is just a warning, because I have seen people looking at the experiment and just this and comparing to their whatever calculation, and then you can make a small mistake, quantitative.
So, does this energy conservation argument work? Just, you know, you have a...
What energy?
The energy conservation. So you have a photon that comes, breaks your Cooper pair, and then you have a free particle. Right. So this delta function.
Of course, this is not really delta.
The energy conservation.
This is a Lorentzian in a real experiment. So.
Lorentzian.
Yes. Yeah, but. So, in real life there are no delta functions. So when you calculate the thing, you have to replace this by a Lorentzian, which has the line width of that.
But at zero temperature.
It has nothing to do with temperature. Okay, so this argument holds now even in homogeneous case. And now you get further complications because of the trapping. So this, let's call it no Pauli blocking. First issue, the second is the trap.
What is no Pauli blocking? What does it mean?
What?
I don't understand what it, again, what is the meaning of no Pauli blocking?
You don't have any particles here, and therefore you will see the peak at some other place than delta.
So I have some single particle excitation energy at the first square root.
Yep.
And that should equal the recoil energy, right? The top of atoms and recoil energy from the normal state Green's function. That would give you the EK, but I don't understand why there's a second here.
This one?
Yes. And the EK should probably have the other side.
No, it's this way, really. If you put this one zero in this.
Okay.
No, it's this way. Yeah, this is maybe useful to think that in the superfluid you create first two excitations and then one of them goes there. And then if you calculate the...
It must be minus sign, because if delta is zero, then you expect everything to be concentrated in one point. It's always...
So, okay, if delta is zero and you are below the Fermi level, you have to take, you know, this gives the absolute value. And therefore you will flip this. And then it gives you. So you can. So you can say.
The second mu, I mean the mu SF, I mean in the extreme VEC side, you'd expect the C2 to give you that refining energy. But I think you've shifted it in so that.
In the VEC side, this guy becomes negative. And then you get again the right ones.
But just naively, you've just got molecules and you need to, and you're breaking up the molecules, you've got to put enough energy to break the molecules.
Well, that's the mu.
That's why the mu.
Yeah, and then it really comes here, but you have to remember that this is negative in the BEC side. Maybe this helps. Let's say that we have initially, we have a the particles, two particles in the superfluid, they have this energy, and final, you have one excitation in the superfluid and one excitation in the normal. And this, of course, sorry, must be the other way around. This would be the and then you so this is the final and that's the initial. This must be also plus. And you subtract this one from these ones and that's what you get here. Okay, so just to remember, if you ever want to do some quantitative thing. So the issue with trapping is, that in the trap, the order parameter is non-uniform and therefore, when you average over all positions, this causes broadening in your peak again. I mean, it's sort of on top of this thing, you get still this one. So the signal gets a bit broad because you average over different deltas. And also, because here delta is very small, it goes quite close to zero. So this is an issue if you want to see whether there are some excitations close to the Fermi level and so on. It's a bit difficult in the trap. If you have more homogeneous system, it's better. And what the third point that I wanted to make is the Hartree fields. So in principle, I have a shift of the peak that is proportional. Let's say I have initially the particles in state 2, so they feel a Hartree shift because of the interaction with 1, and then that has to be differentiated from the, sorry, 2, 3, no, sorry. What the particle in the end state, 3, how does it feel, the Hartree interaction with state 1? So your spectrum should, in principle, contain this kind of shift. So all spectra should be shifted by this amount. And in a trap, this becomes again a nuisance because, of course, the densities vary with position. So you have to calculate and so on. But the lithium 6 case, this one is a very fortunate special case because there you have a Fesbach resonances for this 1-2 and 1-3 quite close nearby. And probably, I mean, this is not 100% established, but it seems that when you go to the resonance of this one, you are also so close to the resonance of this one that they are both unitary limited and therefore they are the same and you don't basically see the Hartree shift. I mean, so you now Ketele is seeing it and it's small, but it, yeah, it's there. I will show it in but here we did not really see it, or maybe there is, I don't know.
It's not easy in what temperature region?
Yeah, well, I have the pictures in this talk. Okay, so yeah, this is just an example how the peak is. Peak, this one is not at the same place as the density of state divergence. So this was all that I wanted to say about RF spectroscopy, except from Ketteler's experiment. So I think we can go on if there are no more questions. Oh, only 1 hour. Okay. So some notes about this polarized thermigases. You know all the experiments and so on, and beautiful pictures. So what we did there is that we considered this system using Vogel-Hubert again equations, which describe the effects of the trap very well. It's still just mean field theory, and here is no pseudo gap and so on, but we solve everything in the basis of the harmonic oscillator. And then, okay, I wanted to say that a lot of people have worked on this topic recently. And we did LDA comparison, and this is boring. We have now 20,000. And we do it on resonance. So we can really, we are really in the unitarity limit. This requires huge number of trap states. And that's what is different for some other people who have also done this type of things, that they are in the BCS limit, where it's not so heavy numerically. But this one? Yeah, I will explain.
Oh,
yeah.
You just started, okay.
Yeah. No, I'm just commenting what is the difference for some other work, that we have high particle numbers and high interactions. That's non-trivial numerically. So these are the kind of density profiles that we get for the imbalanced gas using Vogel-Hubert-Degens equations. And this is the gap, and this is a majority component and minority component, and the same here. And the specific feature that comes from these Vogel-Hubert-Degens equations are these wiggles of the order parameter at the end of the gas. So this is something like FFLO. We very carefully call it FFLO type features, because we don't claim that that's the FFLO state, but it's the same thing in the sense that here you really have an imbalanced gas, so this much of minority and this much of majority component, and you still have some order parameter and it oscillates.
What is the spatial scale at which you oscillate? What is the characteristic scale?
Yeah, so this is now plotted in a Thomas Fermi unit, and we have tried to see how this scale, I mean,
this is a unitary point?
It's very close. It's a KFA minus 2. Yes. Yes.
I mean, those oscillations are Fermi surface effect. Not at all. Not Fermi surface.
I think all of state could also have Fermi surface.
Well, I know. In mean field theory, right, is from Fermi surface.
Yeah, I don't know in which sense you mean Fermi surface.
Comparable to, say, Fermi momentum.
So, okay, as you see from here, it depends on the polarization. For higher polarization, you see more wiggles. The scale seems to be the same. And we have tried to see whether this is, a effect of finite number of particles. And when we raise the particle number, we see that it basically scales like RTF. So in real space, it stays the same, but if we plot it in this scale, it decreases. So we can conclude that they go kind of smaller and disappear with the particle number to power 1 over 6, which is good, because we were afraid that they would go away immediately, but it's power 1 to 6.
Is it
what scale is 106? The magnitude?
No, the wavelength. Yeah. And actually, when we increase the particle number, it like it goes deeper, but with smaller wavelength.
Also,
in this case.
Number effect. Finite particle number effect. So in the limit of n goes to infinity, it would go to zero.
It's like a boundary effect. So in real space, the boundary would be the same, but if you plot it with the RTF, when your system grows, the boundary becomes smaller compared to the whole system. Yeah. So basically, what we can say that for these particle numbers and also for the ones that are used in experiments, it is still there. It's sort of like mesoscopic effects, but it's pretty small. So I don't know. Yes.
I guess the course feature is the space separation, is it?
Yeah. But I didn't talk about this because it's so obvious. Everybody knows now. Like, everybody is completely bored about it.
Well, what if we phase? Do you have a phase diagram?
Not really. It's also a bit difficult to define here. These people, this Japanese group. They have calculated in the BCS limit where you can calculate this easier. And they call, whenever you have some kind of wiggles here, they call it FFLO. So, I mean, what do you really call FFLO and what not? Because depending on your polarization, this feature is here. It's sometimes bigger, sometimes smaller. So, yeah, but then it's you have done it already. Yeah.
You could make little density approximation, read off the chemical potential there. That's your base, can't
you? Yeah. You can do something like this. Okay. So we also wanted to see that do you get for some polarization? Oh no. Okay. First, how one could observe it with RF spectroscopy. So we suggested this kind of thing that. Here, what you expect nicely is that.
Can I ask a question? If you take their results and do LDA, I mean, is LDA good, or can you say?
For seeing these ones? I mean, if we do LDA, we get this more or less the same, but then these are very difficult to reproduce from LDA.
This is from the track usually.
Yeah. Some people have tried, but they got funny results like that. The LDA wavelength is bigger than the area where it should exist, and this kind of thing. So it's very difficult to implement inside LDA. Yeah, it's real because it's a trap. It's very collisionmetric and but somehow gives the symmetry breaking. So one could, in principle, see this by RF spectroscopy. So what would you expect sort of in any case? So this blue one is the minority component. This one, which is almost invisible, is the majority component. So the minority one, yes, everybody is paired. For the majority one, there are some unpaired. And this is now zero temperature plot. So even in zero temperature, some of the majority ones are unpaired, as you know. But if you have this kind of funny FFLO stuff, you will have also some unpaired minority particles at the nodes of the order parameter. Here it has nodes. So zero gap also, and there are some minority particles. So then you could see this kind of peak at zero temperature. And actually Ketele has looked, he comments in his paper that they looked for this, but they didn't see it. But I can believe it, because even for us, we have to really find the right parameters to see it. Like this picture is for this situation, and we see it. But if the wiggles are too small, we don't see it.
So by this logic, you really mean that in principle you have an edge, right, where delta disappears. Even if you don't have wiggles, it's the end. Order parameter turns into zero.
Yeah, but according to LDA, also the minority component goes to zero at the same point as the. But then there are no particles that would give this signal.
There are a few particles in the version of the
thing. Yeah, but then it would just go to zero, like here.
Yeah.
Which is easy. Yeah. Well, and this is a feature, but it's invisible. Okay.
Because there's also the gap turns into, you're saying gap turns into zero, but density still.
Yes, so here, at some points your order parameter goes to zero, but unfortunately it's almost invisible how this minority component goes, but there are some finite, really finite number of them at the node.
But if the order parameter would be complex, like this e to ik oscillation,
then if the order parameter is just e to ik whatever, then it's homogeneous. It's just the momentum. So you need to have really this kind of real and oscillate for this.
Can you say what's the difference between left and right?
This is for this case, and it has both the minority and the majority component spectra. Are they visible at all? So the majority goes like this. There are clearly, of course, unpaired particles and then paired ones. And for the minority one, there are only paired ones. Because in this, for this polarization, these wiggles are so small that they don't produce the effect that we are claiming here.
Oh, I see. That is just the fact that the majority particles are paired.
This peak, yes. But this peak is different. This is also for the minority component. And that's because you have nodes in the order parameter, and there you have still finite number of these unpaired minority particles.
This is a concept of the epithelial space.
Yeah.
It's sort of like gap excitation of the epithelial.
Yeah. But it's very delicate effect in this case. It's difficult to see even in the theory. Okay, and we also looked at for some very extreme polarizations. One can have the oscillation sort of throughout the system. I don't know. It's quite a lot of time spent. And we sort of compared at what scales we would have that kind of thing, that oscillations go through the whole system, and that's basically here, so that's why it's not been seen. But the oscillations as such, they could exist in this region. This maybe is something that for very large polarizations we get this order parameter that oscillates all the way, and then the density difference looks like this. It has this kind of tip.
It would help if you drew the plot. We can't see the lines.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's
actually more lines.
Yeah, there are lines that you don't see.
You can draw them on the board or something.
Yeah, can you see this one?
The black line is all right.
Yeah, but the others are not important. So this one is the density difference between majority and minority component. And when there is this FFLO state, it has this kind of feature that it has a dip here that it doesn't go all the way zero, but it's still smaller than this. And this is something that comes out from FFLO at zero temperature. Or if you have finite temperature, if you have some BP or pseudo gap, it has this one. But it does not come from a strongly interacting normal state. There is a paper by Sringari and others where they show that there, in a normal state, this would be completely flat. So I'm just curious, like they have in Ketteler's paper, they have this kind of thing, but I don't know whether it's real. But yeah, so but just to know that this kind of dips in the density profiles could be a signature of something.
I'm a little confused. So, what do you call FFLO state? Is it affect the law state, or this is your state, which is just non-uniform?
Yeah, this is a, well, here, this is our state. Oh. It is non-uniform, yes. And in this extreme polarization, it, the oscillations, you really see them kind of everywhere and not only at the edge.
Yeah, but it's not the...
It's not, sorry. There should be this kind of quotation marks.
These are four people who probably disagree with you on that.
Why do you say that?
Because I think what they were looking for is the internal feature, which is not related to the spatial symmetry breaking associated with the trap, for example, our fully defined system.
Well, okay, let's assume that locally we can define our own thing as a system, but isn't the
But this is an effect which, as far as I understand, is related to finite size effect. It's the finite size effect which we observe here. And
well, it, yeah, I would say it's some.
Breaking everything in this field is planetary.
Yeah.
Locally, it's a local density calculation oscillating in a gap. Isn't that what they have to locate?
But it's not what what is shown here. That's what I mean. It's not what is shown here.
Yeah, this is homogeneous. It's never FFLO.
You're in a homogeneous system.
Yeah.
With this range of parameters?
No.
Yeah. Theoretically, you can do it. For this range, for this chemical potential or the tuning, you find with the system that the stable. The FFLO state is stable. If it is, and then you put in the trap, okay, it will modify somehow. Yeah. It will be confined to some region. Then, then I think by definition, that would be FFLO state. But if it's you're in a regime where the completely homogeneous people material take separation or something, and then you put on the trap or you can start with it.
Yeah, so somehow in some, for low polarizations, it's clearly like an interface effect. So in some sense, you have a superfluid field, superfluid and a ferromagnet. And you know that if you combine them and really calculate it, you get some oscillations.
It's just it's a finite width of the phase boundary. So if you make the density approximation, your phase boundary is a singularly observed width between the normal state and the superfluid state. And then here, if you do Bogley-Brazil or whatever, you get some structure of that phase boundary. But you can't call it a phase, as such, because it doesn't have...
Yeah, I don't know how, what to call it, but...
The phase boundary.
But as far as not phase, the feature, and just the plane where it's sent from, what's the line position?
It's just the bearing. Reduces the difference a little bit, but you can still have different numbers, so it doesn't go to zero. Yeah, just a comment to this thing. So you see that when you have really large polarization, like here, the order parameter goes like this. So somehow it goes through the whole system, so the boundary becomes then very large compared to this. But that's for extreme polarization. So changing the polarization, you can see basically what you want, a boundary effect or something that is already away from a boundary effect. But okay, then we have considered the optical lattice, and they are very simple FFLO state and everything is known. But what we calculated and what has not been calculated for this type of system is to compare with phase separation. So when is it possibly advantageous to have a real FFLO state in a lattice? And now I think I can call it a state or phase. And when it is better to separate to some PCS region and normal region. And we do this by varying the size of the PCS region and the particles that are there. And
what
this is a quite a shallow lattice, and the interaction strengths are not extreme at all. They're just like the background scattering length and so on.
And psi k is the band.
The lattice dispersion comes in here. So the thing that we find here, sorry, this is now the phase separation regime. This is temperature, this is polarization. And what we see here is that this FFLO region is much bigger than in many other contexts. Like people have calculated this for homogeneous systems, and it seemed to be quite narrow. And then, as you saw from my trapped example, it's something in the end, and so on. But here it's typically quite large, and it's not so sensitive to like small variations in the parameters. Yeah, this is phase separation. So it's for low polarizations and low temperatures. Sorry? This is for quite weakly interacting system. I assume the interaction strength of like the just the background scattering length of potassium.
Oh.
So it's not.
So like BCS region.
Yeah, BCS region. Yeah.
So lead isn't good because the firm source is now more.
Yes. I think the whole thing comes from this effect from the Fermi surface, because here we plot as a function of filling and polarization. And now look at, for instance, these black curves, not the dotted one. So above here is normal state, and in between these lines is FFLO, and here down is phase separation. This is the filling. This is density. This is half filling here, at zero. So you see that, and these dotted lights are the same thing for different parameters. I don't remember the values, but they are quite small, and they are not like multiples of the. But it's incomprehensible. Yeah.
Then does it depend on the boundary conditions you put, or what kind of boundary conditions do you have in your lattice?
We have periodic boundary conditions.
So
you
do this. No trap, it's just
a. Yeah. But I come to the trap issue soon. But this was for homogeneous. So what you see here is that for low fillings, which corresponds to the continuum case, this window where you have this FFLO is a bit smaller, especially here. It really goes to quite small. But then for larger fillings, when this Fermi surface is already very different from a homogeneous system, you get a much bigger this FFLO window.
So your lattice is weak enough so that your fermion band is really free, it's more or less spherical, is that right? Does your Fermi surface already rather deformed already? Like,
yeah, it is. If you take this kind of fillings.
Yeah, right. So then you and this is for three dimensional.
Yeah. Q in one, this is the simplest answer. Yeah, so that's what
the. Like a continuum of view in a BCS side, what interaction?
Weak interaction. Yeah, I don't know in which parameters you want to see, but. So, in recoils, U equals this much of recoils. And in real numbers, it's something like minus 300 Bohr radius. It's really weakly interacting.
I
don't
understand why there are two sets of.
Just to show for two different interactions.
So these
for stronger interaction. So stronger interaction makes it, of course, bigger, the fellow area. Yeah, and about the trapping, the thing is that here we get the energy for FFLO state, we get the energy for phase-separated state. And we can make many very rough estimates that if we now have a harmonic overall trap, if you move particles from here to the middle, how much do you win per particle? And we can compare that energy to how much you win by being in FFLO and not phase separation. Because somehow in the trap, this phase separation would be additionally good. So the difference in the energy between a FFLO and phase separation has to be bigger than what you can additionally gain from the trapping. And we estimated that, for instance, if you want to achieve this, the trap, the overall trap should be something like 100 hertz, yes, or some other like reasonable number, not 10 to minus 5 hertz or something. So it's good news in that sense. Okay. And yes, and then you can observe it easily in the momentum distribution. It's a symmetry breaking, but this is a little bit maybe over-optimistic in the sense that here we have put by hand this ansatz that there is only one Q, so of course you see very unsymmetric. In reality, you might have some other state which has several Q modes. But still, if there is some symmetry breaking, you probably see it. We tried both. This figure. Yeah, it's like here. Yeah, so we tried also varying, making, you know, like this, and it doesn't change much. This is the density difference. This one. In momentum space. So density difference in momentum space, and you can really see it there. Well, but of course, if you combine much more modes, this becomes different. It's not so easy. But on the other hand, having more modes would make this FFLO energy even lower, so that makes it more robust. Okay, so if somebody is interested, we can discuss about this new experiments by Ketele. So he has done this RF spectroscopy at various points of the phase diagram, and this is the phase boundary that they have got by condensate fraction and vortices. So here is superfluid according to them, and then they take spectra at various places. This has just for which parameters did they take the spectrum? So we worked here, we worked there. And I will now show the results, how does spectrum look like there. So this is not a measurement, this is just where we are. Which parameters have they looked at? Yeah, and here for instance, if they look at these parameters, this is what they see. So these are certainly not superfluid. They are very far here for very large imbalance, quite high temperature. And they see pairing also there. So this is the highest temperature, this one. You see the peak at zero, so no pairing. And then the pairing starts to appear, it appears. And finally, already at this point, the gas is, the minority component is totally paired. So, yeah, that's what they see pairing in the normal state. And
meaning there's no peak at zero offset. That's what you mean?
Yeah. So
there's
something
there.
This one, yeah. maybe this is my FFLO state. Yes. Okay, and and here is the Hartree field. Yes, this there, look. This is 50 from here. This is the Hartree field, the Hartree shift. That's what they say, and I think it is. So there is might be some small difference between this gathering. I don't know, but that's clearly there. So the claim that, or the point that they make.
Sorry, I didn't follow it. Which notations are actually?
Yeah, you see that this peak shifts from zero. Oh, so the zero. whole curve is kind of shifted by the Hartree field. So here you.
You can check that by moving around toward closer to the resonance.
Yes, yes, and that's what they did already many years ago. They looked at this Hartree. No, Ketele did this first. So they they really looked at this shift far away from the resonance, and you see it, and then when you come to resonance, it disappears because it seems that both of these become unitary delimited and therefore the same. But there seems to be some small effect left.
And is it compared to the vacuum value or no density value for the transition? I mean, the offset is compared to what?
To the time.
Yes. So the point that they make about these ones is that, and also points here, is that the pairing is no precursor for superfluidity, because here they never see a superfluid, even if they go to zero temperature. So pairing, but superfluid never comes. Okay, that's one has to also trust that their phase diagram is right, but...
Yeah, because within mean field theory, that would be a super...
Yeah, that's the point. Maybe that's an interesting point to throw here.
Is it really curve your calculation or their fitting?
It's their fitting. There are no calculations by me.
So I don't...
This is all catalyst.
But the experimental points are only... There's only experimental data. So why is the superfluid curve going, making a kink downward in the end?
I don't know. That's what they have measured.
They have measured it.
Yeah. They have measured. This is according to their measurements. I can show how, but.
But how can they go to temperatures this low? I see that.
Okay, I think here it's extrapolation.
Yeah, to be, I'm making a sharp downturn.
But they can go here. Maybe this one is just extrapolation.
I thought that's the whole point of this experiment. Yeah. Because if you could continue this without making the king,
yeah.
I don't think they can
compensate. Okay, I say something about this. So this is at unitarity. And their critical polarization is 0.77. So this is Ketterle. And the mean field looks like this. Some nicer curve. If you calculate mean field theory for this imbalance gases, and many, many people have done it, you end up at 1, so the critical polarization at unit...
You end up at 0.93.
0.93. Okay. What's this mean field? This is maybe some more elaborate.
This is really large.
Oh, how large is it? Which way is it?
Lower is it too far?
But this is at zero temperature. This is mean field theory at zero temperature.
No. Like this. Of course, this is...
zero temperature?
No. This is temperature, this axis. Yes. This is a phase diagram with polarization and temperature. And so, of course, mean field theory here is wrong, but maybe here could be a bit better, but... So... Yeah. Okay, so, of course, we should not believe mean field theory, but there is something interesting that it's really... considerably different from Ketterle's measurements. So either Ketterle's measurements fail a bit here, maybe they don't see any more vortex, even if there is some superfluid, or the mean field theory is really that much wrong.
How do they notice the temperature?
They measure it from the edges of the majority cloud. So the majority cloud, you know, the edges, they don't see any of these minority atoms, so they are like more or less Thomas Fermi. So you can make a Thomas Fermi. So it should kind of work. And they, for instance, here, low polarization, when all the majority atoms are interacting, then this temperature measurement is not so good. But they, it should kind of work here, but who knows?
Without imbalance, what is C? Without imbalance, it's 0.2. Stefan?
Yeah, according to them. This is log scale, so...
But the lowest they can go is 0.1 PC, so I don't know if they can make a sharp...
Well, this for instance, is 0.08. That's maybe the lowest that they can. So it's of course important to, for this statement, it's important to know whether there is a superfluidity or not. So is this bearing a precursor for superfluidity or not?
Accurately,
well,
can they really determine TC? Because they are using, to get TC,
mm.
they are using, say,
the vortex as an indicator. Yes, and also the condensate fraction. And the condensate fraction. But when you say vortex,
finite temperature
and zero temperature
state.
Yeah,
this could.
So, how accurately?
Vortex, they have a plot, number of vortices. But it's hard to tell whether you are seeing one or two or
any. Yes, I think this vortex thing is you can assume that you really, if it's very small superfluid, you don't see the vortex there. Condensate fraction should be better, but now we come to the what you explained, the sweep, and you have to remember that at finite temperatures the gap can be small, and there are some excitations which have very small gap, in like in BP state. So maybe you lose them when you do the sweep. I don't know, but this is one more motivation for studying this sweep process better, because that's basically the way of determining this thing. So that's one thing. What else? The temperature scale should be better.
The temperature should be better, but what they are detecting is very subtle. So to say that it will reach TC or not reach TC,
that's true. Yeah, whether the condensate fraction is still there or not, and it's a subtle. So I certainly would think that there is some error bar here, but how big, I don't know. Okay, here, for instance, all are paired. And then along this line, everybody's paired. And again, so high in temperature you see pairing. It doesn't completely pair, but still. And these curves, they are for quite low polarization, so they should now correspond to Rudy's experiments. Just put how they look similar. This one looks like this, and this looks like that. But that's what one expects. And then I made myself this kind of lines, which points are completely paired. So, for instance, this one is completely paired, but this is not. So somehow the imbalance helps having everybody paired, and this is a. So if you have the Thomas Fermi of the majority cloud and the minority cloud, so this here, this is almost constant. So it seems that this pairing, it really cares about the Fermi energy of the majority guys. And that's really, because this is still homogeneous, but this is homogeneous, and that gives you very narrow and nicely paired peaks here.
What is the TDF? Is it TDF for
average? Oh, I would guess it's average. I didn't check. This is log scaling. No, not the superfluid, that 2TF, no.
It's majority.
No, but I mean, you can measure the TDF for minorities, and then you can have temperatures, you know, room temperatures.
Well, yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, it's either majority or the average. It doesn't care. But it's certainly not the minority.
From the majority, I think they're plotting the majority temperature because that's how they extract it.
No, but.
I think they extrapolate.
Yeah. Okay, so that's my comment simply that. They seem to like the, I mean, there's a Fermi level of the upper majority guys seems to determine the pairing, and that this area here is important. By the way, related to this one, they saw one in figure three, they saw also pairing, and that's for something like KFA. Was it minus half or minus one? I don't remember now. But there, and then for polarization 0.88. And that point, also mean field theories say that there is no superfluid here. So that figure is actually, quite essential, because they certainly can find places where at high temperatures or finite temperatures you have pairing, and in zero temperature no pairing. So they had one plot like that.
But why is it, it's equal to mystery when there's pairing at finite temperature above TC as when TC is zero? What difference does that make?
Well, I don't know. They say that, because
pairing above.
Well, for instance, here everybody is accepting something like pseudo kappa, what kind of thing, but.
But in terms of, in principle, I don't see any difference in the difficulty or the complexity of the puzzle.
Yeah, I don't know. So,
I guess another way of asking is why do we call it, why is it pairing at all? Why not just a normal state self-energy, which is temperature dependent? And,
well, sure.
Very
difficult because there's no clear definition of what it is.
We
don't know how to define it. We know what we see.
That's right.
I don't.
But
what it is a shift in the energy of particles which are immersed in this.
Yeah, but it's at least not the simplest heart free type of shift.
No, it's not because it's temperature dependent. But it's a very trivial
thing. It's a simple
thing. I disagree with the word phase. What do you mean by phase?
Right. Okay, let's say it were to continue to zero temperature.
Yes.
Okay, now we can talk about phases at zero temperature.
Well, even at finite temperature, we talk about phase.
Okay, fine. So it's a state of matter, let's say, that has pairing but no phase coherence.
I have no idea what that means.
Well, that means you can calculate correlation functions that don't have long range order and therefore no phase coherence. But at the same time, it has an energy gap.
Well, there's no energy gap. Because it's a feature of Bomb-Fischer spectrum. There's no energy gap at any excitation.
No, there is.
What do you mean? There is an energy gap.
Yes.
There is an energy gap.
Yeah.
If you take that thing.
Why do you say there is an energy gap?
What does that mean?
Well,
why?
Is there a non-analytic feature of spectral function?
On the spectral wave. Well, actually, in finite temperature, you'll always have zero and non-zero spectral wave as your energy.
Fine. So let us talk about zero temperature.
You are saying whether
zero temperature. Okay. There's no such. It violates Leibniz's theorem. There's no such phase.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree. It violates Leibniz's theorem.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it cannot exist.
So you say that the, is there any gap or not?
Because you can have quantum fluctuations which could destroy it. Just the thermal fluctuations are destroying it.
Okay, no, I agree. That's so that's, so this, that's the whole question.
You just say what is the model that produces something.
You know, the whole question is what kind of...
On the lattice, for example, you could have it. On the lattice, you could have it. It would be a superpower
scenario. A model that produces kind of...
If you had there at zero temperature, what would make them be...
No, but it's kind of...
Quantum fluctuations can destroy that.
Look at the picture. There's a
yeah.
Yes, but you can see from these two peak structures that it's not this simple Hartree shift.
Because it appears and this one is still there.
But wouldn't you just say that there was one self, there was one energy at the edge and one self energy in the middle and those are your two peaks?
Yes, but then you would have to have really sharp, like strange kind of density.
But you only have that one.
It's supposed to be this higher than that.
Which is zero in some places and finite in another, and that gives you two peaks. So. Suppose you have a self-energy which is a very sharp function of either position of the trap or...
I mean, this is enough if it's a sharp function.
Yeah, sure.
But what I'm saying that the very most trivial Hartree fields don't give this double peak structure because there it's very smooth. It just gives a shift and that's it.
It should be allowable form.
Yeah, but then you have to, should have a theory that produces this kind of really non-trivial dependence of the self energy.
Yeah, but it doesn't have like a gap.
There comes from
I think. Well, this is quite, I think, quite nice to call it a gap, but.
The gap leads to this discussion which is going on, which is whereas in fact, the
indication
that zero temperature, this thing is a Fermi liquid with a self energy, which. Where the other gap goes away, but this is a self energy shift. And that's it.
Whatever. Yeah. But it has at least a very non-trivial dependence on parameters, the self-energy, whatever it is. So maybe it's not good to call it gap. But.
Maybe we should just focus on, you know, getting this positive part in the residue. That would be a good claim for
somebody.
So I'm not an expert.
No.
It'd be nice. So for example, one can ask a question in that above 0.77 in that region. We all think you'll get there's no pairing there. If it's no pairing and no FFLO, then there must be a Fermi surface. There are well-defined quasi particles. And what is the residue of the quasi particle?
You mean no superfluid here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are some downstream. What is the quasi particle residue?
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that Leo and I have been thinking about and we think of a way of securing.
Yeah.
Is there a way of
measuring? Because there's no Fermi blocking. You're not really concerned about what's going on with the surface.
You're looking at the downspin electron. It's not Fermi surface. It's essentially zero Fermi.
You mean because you want to go to 1?
Yeah, let's say we're very close to 1, 0.99. And then the downspin can still have a non-trivial quasi particle residue. Maybe that's related to this bump over there. I mean, is there any connection of this height of this peak to the quasi particle residue? Is that a reasonable interpretation of this peak?
It's like the spectral weight and. Yeah, this one.
So what is any understanding of the height of that peak?
Yeah, well, this depends on many. You can basically. This is now in numbers of atoms, so it depends on your on the power of your RF feed.
When you were doing the theory, right? Were you able to get that height of the peak?
Yes, if we do something else than linear response. In linear response, it's in arbitrary units. That we did some other stuff, basically, like you have to normalize and then you can get it.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, so,
but it's proportional to. You have to.
So, for example, you had data varied before for the almost that for the balance case. The data varied temperatures and the height of the peak was changing. Actually.
Yeah.
That didn't seem to matter.
Yeah, so don't.
Capture that in your theory.
This thing has in front the. intensity of the laser or the RF field.
So let's take two different temperatures where the prefact is the same.
Yeah.
Let's look at the relative height. It seems like in the experiment the height is changing quite a bit, and in your theory
it's yeah. Yeah, because they vary this from experiment to experiment to get better signal to noise.
All the time.
Yeah. That's what they do here too. So sometimes they
heights of A, B, C, and D at all.
Well, you can always compare the height of this one to this one.
Right, sure.
This you can, but then between these ones, not really, because they just decide how many particles to move to get a good result.
Well, you think? I mean, they were looking at supergravity one for the first part of the talk. We're talking about the supergravity phase. So then you think looking at U's and V's, how they vary.
Well, I see that unitarity, and now there's no reason for BCS to work. So maybe that even there's some non-trivial quasi-particle residues.
Yeah. So nobody has calculated yet, you know, something that would fit there. And I think I would not do it. But yeah. So you would just have something different here.
Right. I'm saying within this model, within her model, how they
yeah, they make
yeah.
More.
So you would have something different here if you do the linear response. If you can calculate the Green's function for whatever state you have, you would just plug it in. Okay, I think that's it.
Thanks.